Hi, everyone. Welcome to Luxury Insight podcast in partnership with the Fashion Network. My name is Jonathan Ciboni, and I'm the CEO of Luxury Insight, which is the first data platform and agency in the luxury industry. We'd like to start 2019 with a new way to discover luxury insights and kind of give you a behind-the-curtain view of the forces and people driving the industry. So today, we are very happy and honored to have with us Stanislas de Kersis, who's the former CEO of beautiful houses like Cartier, Van Cleef & Arpels, as well as Godfrey Dini, who's the editor-in-chief of Fashion Network. They will have a great discussion about their experiences and trends on the luxury market.
Hello, everybody. My name's Godfrey Dini, and I'm here with Stanislas de Kersis. Hi, Stanislas.
Hi, Godfrey.
Stanislas is a true expert in luxury who's had a very brilliant career in the industry. He has been the president of one of the world's greatest jewellery brands, Van Cleef & Arpels. He was also a president of Richemont, one of the greatest luxury conglomerates in the world. He was a member of the directoire of the Comité Colbert, which is French luxury's governing organisation. And he is currently a sophisticated investor with a company called SAVIH, which invests in startup in technology and luxury. We're honored to have him here today. It's not often we get a chance to speak to a person who's had such a brilliant career. But I'd like to begin at the beginning and ask Stanislav, when did you first get the idea you would have a career in luxury?
You know, I was born in Reims, which is the city of Champagne. And as a teenager, to make money, I was harvesting grapes at the end of the summer before going back to school. And I loved, you know, this idea of taking the best of earth, you know, the grapes, of, and to mix it with the best of mankind, the craftsmanship in the cellar, and to create a great, the great champagne. And also to learn patience, because you need to wait 3 years to be able to drink the champagne. After that, I went into business school, started at Procter & Gamble because I loved the American vision of the world. I love this Anglo-Saxon direct way, and I love marketing, which is to be interested by the desire of the clients, their understanding of the consumer, and I love the world of strategy and global brands. After that, I'm married. Unfortunately, I lost my first child, called Alban, of sudden death syndrome. And it was a shock for me. And when he was buried, the priest said, Alban, that was his name, he was loved and he loved. He had a successful life. Let us have also a successful life. And then I realized that you could have a successful life by being loved. And I realized that he had also an emotional side. Proctor was very rational. And so I shift career and went into luxury because I think in luxury there is a lot of emotions, there's a lot of creativity, and also rational side. So you have the two aspects, the left brain, right brain. And I enjoyed this world, starting first at Montblanc in France, when we started to go from wholesale into retail, from pen manufacturer into a real luxury brand, with creation of the leather, fragrance, eyewear, watches, jewelry. Then moved to president of and CEO of Montblanc in America.
To interrupt you a second, this was 30 years ago when you began your career, or
yes,
25 years ago. Why is it, in the last few years, all the great luxury groups, LVMH, Kering, Richemont, above all, have taken graduates from Procter & Gamble? What is the secret? Just, I'd love to know that.
I think the idea that you need to have intuition, is, you know, luxury is about intuition, you know, but you need also to rationalize it and conceptualize it and with strategies. And I think, you know, fast consumer goods and with Procter & Gamble as an example are very good companies to put things in strategy, to duplicate good practices and to have worldwide expertise. So it's a force to accelerate the growth of luxury. And I think, you know, if you think of it, Picasso was a great painter, but he had also a gallery. And the gallery was helping me to become known on a worldwide basis and to have, if you want, an expansion strategy. So I think this is probably why you had a successful P&G in luxury industry.
And after Montclair, you were saying, where did you go then?
So I was, you know, the president of Montblanc in America.
Yes.
Then Alfred Denil, I was the international marketing director for Alfred Denil, based in London, which was, you know, understanding how to create product. Then was promoted president of Cartier in France. So very retail, high-end with, you know, high-end with haute joaillerie. Then was promoted president of Cartier in America. Then was promoted president and CEO of Van Cleef & Arpels Worldwide, which is an incredible journey because we grew tremendously this beautiful, it was a sleeping beauty at that time, but to make it one of the most profitable brand of Richemont and with strong recognition all over the world. Then I was promoted president and CEO of Cartier, which is the number one brand of Richemont. And then after that, president of Richemont for France. And now I'm advising companies. I'm a board of several companies, Barnes International Real Estate, Rémy Cointreau, and also an investor and mentor of startups, because I believe that we live in an environment where, you know, there's a room for new ideas, disruption. Data is a great way to disrupt and accelerate the success and the growth.
What were the lessons you learned in terms of acquisitions? You were in that group in a period where they acquired quite a lot of companies in watches, in fashion, and developed them. What were the parameters they used that you learned that you apply to what you do today?
If you stand back, Godfrey, if we try to understand what makes those luxury brands successful, first, it starts with an expertise. So Louis Vuitton, expert in trunks and leather. Louis Cartier, expert in jewelry. Alfred Van Cleef in jewelry. Then from this expertise, you know your customer and you listen to your customer. You listen to your clients. And what do they tell you? Number one, they say, oh, please, could you make something which is more accessible? Because I love this high jewelry that I'm wearing on during galas, but I also have got a day life. I need day jewelry. So Van Cleef & Arpels probably invented and created Alhambra. Cartier invented the Love and the Trinity. So you got what we call democratization. First way to expand. The second way, the clients are telling you, look, could you create something? You're so talented. I love the way you create, but could you do something different? For example, I love the jewelry, but my husband would like to have a watch. Mr. Cartier, could you design a watch? And then this is called diversification. So all those brands start to diversify. And now Hermès is in watches, in fashion, in furniture, in fragrance. So the second way to build growth. And the third way is internationalization, because you got clients, and I read the letters of the Cartier saying, I love what you're doing in Paris. I'm an American, but I live in New York. Why don't you come to New York? So, and then you start to build New York, Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Seoul. So from an expertise and a family, you go with the three dimension of expansion, which is democratization, diversification, and internationalization. And all that brings a pyramid, which is the most solid, sturdy architecture there is in the world.
What is it about the French culture and mentality and DNA that makes France such a fertile place for luxury brands? We get them in Italy and Milan, in London, New York, but no country seems so good at doing it. Why is that?
I think it's probably the combination of, number one, this idea about artisan, about art appliqué, about craftsmanship, which dates back to, you know, one good example is obviously Versailles and Louis XIV. But this idea that it's very important to have another form of art. It's applied art, it's decorative art, but it's art. Second is this idea of what is important is what you translate to the next generation. You know how much we value what we call patrimoine, how much we value, you know, castle, cathedrals, and we want to convey them to the next generation. It's like the heritage. So you want to build something for the long term. And third, this idea of we believe that we've got a message for the world. You know, this idealistic revolution ideas, we say it's for the world. So we've got a messianic view. We believe that France has got a message for the world. France is the number one country for tourism. So I think, you know, when you have this idea of craftsmanship, you know, translating to the next generation and a message for the world, plus creativity, we value very much artists. You know, in France, the most revered people are not business people. They're not politicians. They're artists. A writer, a painter, a sculptor in France, is good. So, you know, when you've got this four dimension, value, we value creativity, we value craftsmanship, we value transmission in time, and we value, we believe that we've got a vision for the world.
Many of the luxury brands nowadays are quoted on stock markets. LVMH, Hermes, Ralph Lauren, Kering, Richemont, where you are. So there's a very objective test of Prada is quoted in Hong Kong. Sometimes there's been a little bit of comparison and criticism that maybe Richemont has not performed quite as well in terms of its capitalization as LVMH or Hermes. Do you think that's fair or it's lazy journalism?
I think what is incredible about luxury is, although it's on stock market, it's always controlled by one family.
Yes.
If you think of it, it's atypical. Yeah. It's not the same thing for other industry. And it's probably because there's a relationship with the family and a long-term view. And I always remember Johann Rupert saying, make this company better for my kids than for me. So it's always, you know, building for the next generation. It's everything against short-term view, which is a bit antagonist with your stock market, which sometimes tends to have a short-term view. So it's always making investment for the long-term, investment in manufacturing, in creation, in people. It's having a long-term strategies, which at the end of the day, it does pay on the long-term. And I think fantastic to have on the helm of all those groups you mentioned, whether they're public or not, because Chanel is not public, but same management, one family, and this ability to translate to the next generation.
Okay. With the possible exception of Silicon Valley or high technology, it's been remarkable in my lifetime. That's the industry I've ended up in fashion and luxury, but also that few industries have grown as well and have grown as rapidly. Even in the last recession from 2008, when so many industries could barely keep their turnover, many luxury brands still grew at double-digit growth. Why do you think that is?
Because at the end of the day, it's about something which is essential, which is wellness. Luxury is the ability to say to somebody, I love you.
Yes.
Honestly, you can live without jewelry, you can live without a watch because you got your cell phone is telling you the time. But it's quite difficult, Godfrey, to live without telling somebody I love you because love is essential, even if you start with loving yourself, which is a very good starting point. So if you love yourself, you're going to buy jewelry. And it's also, you feel good. There's a feel-good factor when you buy something which is very creative, which is extremely well-crafted, which is going to endure time. Isn't it great to be able to hand over an Hermes bag from generation to generation? You know, it's or a Vacheron watch from generation to generation. You feel good. You feel good. And you say, by the way, it's also very smart because the jewelry I bought at Van Cleef & Arpels is worth more now at Christie's and Sotheby's than when I bought it. So yeah. you're able to say, I love you. You have this idea of wellness, making good bets, because good purchase because it makes sense from financial point of view. And also more and more you're extremely well taken care of because this idea of the client's behavior, the client journey is very important. We want to take a very personal approach. You know, you feel good because you're recognized. People remember your birthday. People remember all your good occasions. You feel good. So I'm not surprised. It's essential and it will continue to grow.
One brand, I think we're going to go and talk about technology now, but one brand that's always impressed me is Chanel, which is not quoted on the stock market, unlike most of the other ones or many others, and doesn't sell very much on the web. You know, and if you talk to their CEO, Bruno Pavlovsky or Karl Lagerfeld, they always talk about the customer journey, the customer experience. But I was very struck recently that after 50 years of never releasing their figures and apparently even paying a fine to the Tribunal de Commerce in France every year to not release their figures, they finally announced their figures this last year that their turnover was over 9 billion. Why did you think they did that?
Probably because changing time, and you know, there's something new. You know what is very vital for a luxury brand is trust. The only way to build trust in the past was longevity. The fact that you've been around the corner over 150 years, yeah. The fact you've survived First World War, survive 1929 crisis, Second World War, give you credential. They say, okay, you're good enough to be able, so you're the best of the crowd. It was the only way to build, so long way to build trust. Now there's another new way, which is community. The fact there's a community in the digital age, which is telling you there's a large crowd of people saying, I've tested this brand and this is great or it is bad. It's ethical, unethical, makes a huge impact on the trust. So now, and so it will help the emergence of new brands. It's also make the existing brands more vulnerable if they are not 100% ethical and if they're not more transparent, the way things are sourced, the way it's manufactured. So I think to be transparent with number, it's like being transparent with your impact on the environment. It's something which is more requested now to be sure that, you know, you're doing things the proper way.
Technology, artificial intelligence, these are all the buzzwords people talk about nowadays. What do you see the role of technology in luxury and in when you're making decisions about brands?
I think technology and specifically data is an accelerator of success. It's like a booster. If you use data, you're going to be smarter. You're going to be quicker to identify if you got a hit or a miss. It's like now you wouldn't dream of, you know, running around or traveling without a GPS. You've got a GPS in the planes, in the boat, in the car, even when you're walking. So GPS all the time. Now, data and technology is your GPS to know if the product you're launching is making a hit. If this is the case, you need to accelerate the production. If the advertising or the digital advertising you're putting is hit or miss. So this is helping you to accelerate, which is great because if you accelerate on a hit, on a success, on a bestseller, an iconic product, you're going to get better revenue. And it's helping you to stop in case it's a dog, which is also quite important. Otherwise, you're going to have extra overstock. And remember to happen what in a few brands, for example, Burberry, when they had to destroy stock, it's unacceptable now to destroy stock. So you need to be sure that when you're creating a new bag, a new watch, a new jewelry, a new dress, and then data is fabulous. It's really giving you the insight. For example, you know, Luxury Insight as a startup, it's like having a world in focus rather than in unfocus. In focus, you know what's happening in the region. You know what's happening on Instagram, on Facebook. You know what's happening in the boutique. You know what's happening on prices. You really are much more. So it's like having glasses or having electricity in a room. It's better to see and with on daylight than
everything nowadays is increasingly digital. It's hard to find people under 30 who read newspapers.
Yes, correct.
But I always notice too when I go to an LVMH company, or, for example, not to mention it all the time, that they have a daily digest that you can, that all the executives and all the managers, they give it out to thousands of people. And sometimes when you're waiting, it's sitting there, you can read it. And I'm always gratified if I have a story in the digest. But what strikes me is how much there is. It's often, you know, 60, 70 stories.
Yes.
It would take you several hours to read them all. You know, how does a manager or decision maker filter through all that and know what to read and learn the right lesson and not be distracted?
Probably what is very important is the feedback, because I think, you know, at the end of the day, what matters is, is, you know, nothing beats the sales. I mean, if the clients are buying it or not. I love magic and magicians, and I love the mentalist.
Yes.
And you know, the mentalists are great because one believes that they can read into your mind. In fact, they're not reading into your mind. They're just perceptible to a lot of facts in the way you behave, the way you move, your eyes contact. So basically, they're fantastic to gather data and interpret the data. And now with data, you've got companies, startups like Luxury Insight. Euritech is another one. Euritech is a startup where they're analyzing all what's happening on Instagram. The product which are in pictures, the product that they're going, that are seeing more and more, the product that the Instagram with the product which are translated and forwarded to other people, or the one which are decreasing. So they can tell you, look, your handbags is going up through the roof. This one is going down. This dress is up. This watch is down. So it's very important because you got feedback. And then out of this massive number of data, what is important is to focus on what the client, what is their reaction. And the good thing is it's even more true than asking questions to the clients because you don't have the bias of, I'm telling you something, I'm behaving differently. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to have the true factor. Mm. It's really what the way you act. It's not the way you tell me. And also it's predictive because if you're looking at more and more of this, it's because you're looking, you like it and you're purchasing it. So that's good. So it's at same time true and predictive. Mm. So that's fantastic advantage of this data now, which is available and was not available a few years back.
Would you say there is a, in French you say, a décalage, a difference between increasingly a public, a general public, which is wary of big technology, of the big five, that feels that they're invasive, that they that are increasingly offended if they ask some question on their WhatsApp, they immediately get an advertisement on their Facebook, Instagram page or suggesting they do something. And a rational decision maker who loves all this information. Do you think there's a difference of opinion there between the consumer and the manager in their view of technology?
I think this is Socrates who said, when he was asked a question, what is the best thing on earth? He said the best thing on earth is the tongue. Because the tongue, you can tell poems, you can tell I love you, you can sing, you can tell stories. He said, oh, great, the tongue is the best thing. And what is the worst thing? He said the tongue. Because the tongue can lie, can tell rubbish, can insult. So, you know, the same could be applied to what you said. This technology, which is the, which can be, it's like the sword with two edges. It can be used in both sense. But there's a fantastic advantage, and we should embrace new technology because, you know, it's our world. We are 21st century. It's really our world.
When you're investing in companies and startups and technology specifically, what are the lessons you've learned from working in a big, globally ambitious luxury brands that you apply when you're making decisions about where you invest your money?
I think first you need to work on a need or pain. You need to bring a solution to this world. Mm-hmm. You're not creating something for the pleasure of creating it. You need to solve a problem and to bring a definite solution, number one. And this problem needs to be big or this market needs to be big. Second, you need to have a reason for being, differentiation, to bring something new to this world, something unique, something different. And third, team, the quality of the team. Somebody who is able to build talent, to have a vision, to be ethical. So those are the three parameters which are key.
Nowadays in the luxury world, people are increasingly surprised by how much money is spent buying luxury brands. And do you think, and that's partly because people say we're running out of luxury brands to buy. I think everyone was surprised last year when Versace was sold for nearly four times its annual revenue, or LVMH bought a hotel group for several times. Do you think there is now a shortage of brands to buy? And do you think people are making rational decisions to pay so much money to buy those brands?
Well, I think they pay a large sum of money because I think it's worth it. Because, you know, first, it's difficult to buy 100 years of history because it takes time, you know, and then suddenly you can buy 100 years of history. You can buy credential, the fact that you've been able to go from crisis to crisis. You've got stories. And stories have got legs. You got international expansion, and you believe that you're going to accelerate. It's like a rocket. You got stage one, stage two, stage three. You say, stage one has been done. Now I can accelerate because I will expand geographically for some brand which are not...
Some of them not. So Versace was only a 40-year-old company.
Yes.
You know, its founder had died, so... Still, you would still apply that logic.
Because you've got a platform. So from this platform, I believe that your rocket, which is stage two, is worth more than a rocket with stage one because you've already done... The takeoff takes a lot of energy. And then if you buy at stage two, you're going to accelerate and you got a good return. It's not guaranteed, but it's worth it.
And then this diversification, we talked a lot about diversification and brands. The ones you've managed, even how they've went into many different areas. But to go into the hotel business is qualitatively different in a way, is it not?
Well, but at the end of the day, what matters is the client. It's really listening to the clients and the journey he wants to have. And now, as you know, everybody is talking about the client's experience. Yeah. So it's not only the product, it's the emotions. We all love, you know, to tell a story to the kids. And when we are kids, we love to listen to stories. We love to see Netflix because we love stories, which are the best way to create emotions. But to have an experience, you know, an hotel is quite an experience if you think of it, because it's a lot of trust. You even sleep in the room, hopefully with no fire. You eat, hopefully with no intoxication. So there's a lot of trust. So this is the ultimate client experience. Yeah. And if you know clients very well, they can buy your product, but they can buy you also an experience, which is a beautiful journey, an escapade. For me, it's quite natural. It's being attracted to the client. And when we were selling high jewelry at Van Cleef or Cartier, we were creating and organizing events for the clients, taking them for 3 days cruise or 3 days in a beautiful hotel or in a castle. So we were even taking care of the journey. So it's part of the same.
The physical journey.
Physical, absolutely.
What the industry is really about is you are dream merchants, in a way, of tangible objects. But the way you speak about it, it's more an emotional thing than a physical thing.
Yes, it is. I believe that at the end of the day, this is an emotion. And I remember when the people said, I will always remember when my boyfriend offered me this watch. And the watch, it was written, let's meet at 5 o'clock, which is quite, you know, quite... We don't know what happened at 5 o'clock, but it was quite a promising rendezvous, engraved on a golden watch. So you're right. At the end of the day, it's an emotion, something you can tell from generation to generation and, you know, something we can
learn from. You were a member of the Comité Colbert. It's a famous organization. Once again, it's kind of the most famous European luxury assembly of companies. I mean, they have the Walpole in England and they have Alta Gamma in Italy, but they don't quite have as much force. And within Comité Colbert, once again, there was a variety of categories. They've even added avant-garde pâtissiers like Pierre Hermé, and they have Grand Palais. What did you learn from that experience that you're applying?
The idea that we are more co-conquering the world than being competitor. There's no limit. We're talking about emotion. Oh. There's no limit to emotion you can have. So the idea is to expand the market, to expand the expertise in terms of training, to have retail, great retail people, to have artisans. So this idea, we are conquering the world. It's like the gathering of painters. When you're in paintings, you know, les grandes expositions, when you're in a, you know, the Matisse, the Picasso, we're talking to each other to see how they can expand. So the idea, how can we conquer the world together? Is it good time to go to Korea? Is it good time to go to these countries? We need to have proper and strong advertising magazines, strong digital, strong education. So we have a lot of common interest. And that's great to share that and to share the good experience, and also to be ambassador when we were doing all together activities in one country, celebrating America, celebrating Russia, celebrating Japan or China, where we were doing festival where all the luxury brands together were presenting.
We've reached half an hour. So Stanislav de Cursis, dream maker, executive, decision maker, ambassador for French luxury. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Godfrey. It's been a pleasure.